You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Judith Sears Poisson, and I'm so pleased that it's time for our annual show that highlights some of the amazing young people who call Wisconsin home.
Me too. We did this last year for the first time. It seemed like a perfect show to air around the holidays, so here we are again.
We'll hear from a variety of young people who are high school age and younger from all over the state.
Let's start on a more recent interview. It's a little more serious a topic than some of the others today.
One student at Oshkosh West High School took classmates' safety into her own hands during a recent shooting event and led them to safety inside a nearby mosque.
I spoke with Dua Ahmad just days after the event. I asked her what was going on when they first realized something might be wrong.
Well, first of all, we were in our AP English literature class when we heard a gunshot. And my teacher, all he instructed us to do was to run. So we ran out of the nearest exit, which happened to be right in front of the mosque. And one of the students running out of that exit as well also said, everybody run to the mosque. So as everybody is going there, of course, the door is locked and you need to enter a code to open it. So knowing that, I just entered the code and I try to let as many people in as possible.
Now, a lot of people have seen the video online, you opening up the mosque and then holding the door and waving people on in. What was that like in that moment, not knowing really what was going on in your school?
Yeah, I mean, the first time when I was opening the door, that was the first time I could actually stand and process everything. And it just started to hit that something was going on. We were all so, so terrified. It was the fact that we didn't know caused a lot of anxiety.
Mm-hmm. Had you done code red drills, or people call them different things, but drills for situations like this?
Yeah, we've done a few drills. We've done we've talked about what to do in situations of like a lockdown, of barricading the doors and stuff. And we've also done like Alice training. And towards the beginning of the year-ish, we do evacuation drills where we all line around like the football field.
And as you said, it was chaotic, especially on the way over to the mosque. Did you worry that this was the worst case, that this might be one of the active shooter situations that we've seen in other schools?
Yeah, I mean, in that situation, since you don't know what's going on, of course, your mind instantly goes to the worst case possible. So that's all that was racing through my head when we had finally settled down in the mosque. A bunch of people were saying, like, what's going on? Was it a shooting?
And what was your thought as you opened up the mosque, just that this would be a safer space than just being outside?
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't even my idea to go to the mosque. It was one of the kids in my school. So since everybody was going that way, I just thought that the most sensible thing was to let everybody in.
And then once you got everybody in, what did you do next?
Well, I instantly got in and called my dad, and I told him we were just told to evacuate. We don't know what's going on. And he just said, all right, I'm coming with a couple other members of the mosque. And when the teachers instantly took it from there, which was greatly appreciated, we tried to organize by our classes, spread out a little bit, and kind of started to get a little calmer from there. My dad came as well, and he tried to organize everything.
How long was it before you found out that it was safe now at your school?
Probably when we all went to, well, not me, but when all of my classmates went to the nearby middle school, Tipler, where the rest of the students were. That's because the fact that they were able to move from this location seemed that everything was sort of calming down at that moment.
Now, as I said, the videos out there, a lot of people online anyway, have praised you for being clear-headed, for finding a safe place for your classmates. You don't seem to think of yourself as having done anything special here.
Yeah, no, I mean, I just did what anybody would. I mean, the most sensible thing in that situation was to enter the code, of course, and then keeping the door open. I mean, in case the door had gotten shut, that would have been even more chaotic and the situation just would have been worse. So, yeah, I just did what anybody else would in that situation.
It was striking how humble she was. As you heard there, she really believed she hadn't done anything out of the ordinary.
And yet, I really think the image of her holding that door open to make sure that everyone got inside safely really stays with people.
Moving on to a little lighter topic, you talked with a couple of Wisconsin students who are going to the Scripps National Spelling Bee earlier this year.
I did, and it was so much fun talking with them. Aiden Wijaya Kulasuria was a third grader at the time at Blessed Sacrament School in Madison, and Maya Jadav was in fifth grade at Fitchburg's Eagle School. I asked them how they got interested in competitive spelling, and Aiden went first.
I got interested when my teacher said I could qualify for fourth grade spelling and asked me if I wanted to go for the class B's. So then I said, okay, so then when I finished first in the class B, I thought that I really wanted to do all this stuff.
Mm-hmm. What about you, Maya? What do you like about competitive spelling?
So my first time getting in the school spelling bee was actually in second grade, and I spelled the word hoity-toity correctly.
That's a very important word to know.
Yes. And then the audience clapped a lot because I was a second grader.
Wow.
And then my principal said to my parents, we've got a future spelling bee champion there. So that kind of sparked me.
I'm interested how each of you go about preparing. What's your process for practicing, Maya?
I study roots from different languages and also language rules for harder languages, and then lots of other lists.
What's the range of languages that you kind of focus on? Because there are so many languages.
I focus on mostly all of them, a bit from each.
Wow. And you're right. If you know the rules, that can really help you, right?
Yes, it can.
What about you, Aiden? How do you study?
I as well also study the roots, so I also use the Spelling Bee website to help me study. So it has a lot of the words that could be asked there, and then I also use this supporting online dictionary that gives out words every day, so I can study those, and they might be asked.
Mm-hmm. So, Aiden, obviously practicing at home or even, you know, going through things with your parents or maybe siblings, that's one thing. But then being in front of a crowd and the pressure's on, how do you keep calm in those situations?
My dad taught me how to meditate.
Oh, wow. So do you do that before the spelling bee or when do you do it?
Sometimes I just get ready before, and then while I'm doing it, I just try to keep myself calm.
Wow, that's great. What about you, Maya?
I also try to keep myself calm. I take deep breaths and tell myself it doesn't matter how it turns out. You just do your best, and yeah.
And Maya, I know you made it to the National Bee last year. What did you learn last year that you feel like you can use for this year's experience?
Last year, I got my round 2 and 3 words right, but I couldn't advance to the semifinals because my score on the preliminaries wasn't high enough. So this year, I've been studying weird geographical and eponym words that could be on the preliminaries test and also a lot more vocabulary.
Oh, okay. And Aiden, I'm sure you've watched a lot of spelling bees and things like that. Do you have any techniques or tactics that you're going to use?
Yeah, sometimes using, the roots helps. Like, if you ask the origin, if it's a Latin word, it's normally going to use an S. But if it's a German word, it normally uses Z's and K's.
Mm. Okay, so really kind of thinking through it before you jump in and start spelling?
Mm-hmm.
And using the tools that they give you.
Mm-hmm.
So much fun. And they have such great techniques and tactics for preparing for this kind of competition.
I was so impressed with both of them. And they were such sweet kids, too.
I didn't hear a whole lot of spelling going on there, Judith. Did you put them through their paces there?
I did. And then I let them quiz me, too. But to start, I asked Aiden to spell umlaut.
Can you repeat the word?
Umlaut.
Is this Latin?
It is German. Hmm. It is a noun. Would you like me to use it in a sentence? I prepared all this.
Yes.
So the student who was studying German wasn't sure which letter the umlaut went on top of.
Are there any alternative pronunciations?
Not that I'm aware of.
Okay. Umlaut. U M L A U T. Umlaut.
Yes. Woohoo! I wish I had a little bell to ring. Very good. Wow, that was great. And let's see, Maya, I'm going to ask you the word escargot.
Escargot? Is this French?
It's French.
Does it mean a snail used
yes,
for food?
Yes, exactly. It's a noun. Okay. It's a snail used for food.
Could you use it in a sentence, please?
Some people might order escargot as long as they don't know it's a snail.
Escargot. E-S-C-A-R-G-O. G E-S-C-A-R-G-O-T, escargot.
Perfect. Very, very good. All right. So, Maya, you said you have a hard word for me.
Yes. This is the word I think is the hardest that I know of. Rijstafel.
Rijstafel. That is a Dutch word, isn't it? From Indonesia.
Yes.
Shoot, I even know what a rijstafel is, and I'm not sure if I can spell it. Okay, I'll try. Rijstafel. R-I-S-T? No. I'm getting the shaking head. Okay, R-I-S, is that right? No, R... Okay, I'm... Clearly, this is not... Can you spell it for me?
R-I-J-S-T-T... A-F-E-L.
Okay, I'm glad that you said that you thought it was a very hard word because I'm kind of embarrassed. I would never have gotten the silent J. So, okay. How about you, Aiden? Do you have one for me?
Yeah, this is a very long word.
You guys are tough. Okay. What is it?
Pneumono ultramicroscopic silico volcano coniosis.
All right. Well, thanks for coming in. No, I am not even going to try that. Do you have one a little kinder to ask me?
Okay. Blitzkrieg.
Blitzkrieg. Okay. Blitzkrieg from the German.
Yes.
Blitzkrieg. B-L-I-T-Z-K-R-I-E-G. Ooh, all right. I was going back whether it was I-E or E-I. I bet if I studied the rules like you, I would have known that.
Good job pulling it out in the end there. You did Central Time proud, Judith.
Thanks. The pressure was clearly on, but I used their tips to help me.
Coming up, we talk to a teen who's not only a champion curler, but is from a long line of them.
Stay with us here on Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. Coming up, we'll hear from a student who was part of a team that used math to try and get a handle on the vaping crisis.
Now, the 2020 Winter Youth Olympic Games are coming up next month in Lausanne, Switzerland. It'll feature 1,800 teenagers from around the world.
And one of those athletes is from right here in Wisconsin. Rob, tell us about Charlie Thompson.
He is a junior at Memorial High School in Eau Claire. He's been curling competitively since he was 12 and won the U18 National Championship when he was 15. Now at age 17, he finds himself representing Team USA at the Youth Olympics.
Wow, that's incredible. Did you ask him how he got started?
Yeah, let's let Charlie explain.
I'm what I guess you'd call a third-generation curler. My grandpa started curling when he was a bit younger, and he brought my dad out actually 17 years ago. I know that because my grandpa brought my dad out when I was just a baby, and my dad knew of it as an opportunity to come drink with some guys and get away from the house for a little while. And as he got more interested in it, he brought me out when I was a younger kid, and now we're here.
We'll talk about your road now to a big stage here, the Youth Olympic team for the United States. So what did it take for you and your team get to this spot where you are representing the U.S.?
Well, it was certainly no short road. My team consists of me from Eau Claire, Wisconsin, one person from Ohio, and then two people from Massachusetts. So we pretty much are all around the country at this point. And before this team came together, I had met two of the players and never had more than a two-minute conversation with them.
Wow.
The structure of the Youth Olympic Games in curling is what makes it so interesting. It's mixed. Two guys, two girls. And it's an extremely narrow range of kids, and that's for the entire Youth Olympic Games. That's, I want to say, 14 through 17. And what we ended up having to do was we had to put a lot of faith in each other, a lot of faith in the fact that we've never really met. And as this team grew, we played a couple tournaments. We had a bunch of practice weekends. We came into Denver where the trials were had, an extremely strong team starting from absolutely nothing.
You ended up beating out, I understand, 10 other teams at these trials. Did you feel, I mean, coming in, that's a tall order. Did you feel confident with this new team that you had a shot here?
Well, I'll be entirely honest with you. I didn't think we were going to win the thing. I say that knowing full well how strong the teams we faced were. We were coming up against various national champions, players that I've known and played against for the last 5 years. So it wasn't just the fact that they were strong curlers. It's that there's history there. There's players I've beat, lost, and played with. It's such a tight-knit community coming up against them. It was daunting, to be fair.
You'll be headed to Switzerland now, taking on teams from around the world. Do you have that kind of familiarity with international teams that you did with the American teams?
No, and that, I think, can both be a benefit and a problem. I knew exactly how every team we played in that trials was going to play. So we knew what to call. We knew what to throw. We knew how to make them miss. We don't have that same blessing when we're playing these international teams. And neither do they. So it's really going to be a true blank slate going in.
We're talking to Charlie Thompson, junior at Memorial High School in Eau Claire and a member of Team USA's curling team at the 2020 Winter Youth Olympic Games in Switzerland. Charlie, what is your position on the team?
I'm the second, and I actually got there through that was not my original position on the team. For those who are aware of curling, there's four positions: lead, second, vice, and skip. Skip is the position that more or less decides the strategy of the game and throws the last rocks or the most crucial rocks. I initially, coming into this team, was the skip. And I had to make the decision after one of our tournaments where things just weren't clicking. Things just weren't going right. I had to kind of swallow some of my own pride, make the decision to move back and move another player up. And it worked out better than we could have possibly hoped for.
Now, you are a high school student, as I just mentioned, and you're training for this huge international event. Bit of a time crunch here and there?
I don't even know how to explain it. It's extremely daunting. I'm missing upwards of 3 weeks in January,
wow.
One of the most hectic times of the year for school. And I won't lie to you, I'm moderately terrified. But I've had the benefit of great help from Memorial High School. Every person I've talked to has said, you know what, this is a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. We're going to help you get through it. And that's so helpful for a terrified 17-year-old.
As you're looking forward and trying to encounter that terror, what are you thinking? How do you stay focused on just you and your team giving the best performance in Switzerland?
Well, one thing I did going into the trials was I tried to think as little as possible. Curling is one of those sports that you can really think yourself in circles. You can spend 5 minutes deciding on what you want to call for the shot and then miss it. Sometimes you just need to, what I've learned is I need to just go with my gut instinct, go with what I know works for me, which is just let the chips fall. And thankfully that worked out as well as it did.
It sounds like Charlie really has a great time curling, and it's so much fun to listen to him talk about it. So when is the big competition?
The Winter Youth Olympic Games are January 10th through the 22nd in Lausanne, Switzerland. They take place every 4 years and feature 1,800 athletes age 15 through 18.
Wow, that's so exciting. We'll have to follow up on how Charlie and Team USA do.
Speaking of top competitors, I really enjoyed talking with a member of a team from Nicolet High School. Earlier this year, they took part in a national mathematics competition in New York City. Out of nearly 900 teams from around the country, the Nicolet team came in third.
And as I recall, they had to come up with mathematical models to gauge the spread of nicotine use from vaping, how likely someone is to use a given substance, and how many high school seniors will use drugs.
Exactly. I talked with team member Ryan Mortensen just days after the team came in third in the nation. When I asked Ryan how it felt, you could tell he was still really excited.
It feels awesome. It's incredible. I mean, right after we won, I had to go up and speak, and I think I said I felt like I was on a cloud, which is a pretty accurate. Yeah, it's incredible. It's awesome.
And Ryan, tell me about that 14-hour grind. What was that like for you and your team?
Yeah, so we got to my friend's house and went into his basement, and we sort of sat down. At that point, there were only three of the four of us present. One of our members had a Taekwondo tournament, actually. And so we were very unfamiliar with the challenge. So we spent a few hours just sort of trying to get our bearings and figuring out where we were going to start. And they ended up being very helpful, those hours. And sort of we failed a lot in those hours, which helped us to sort of know what not to do and finish strong with the remaining 10 hours. And then our other member showed up and we sort of got going. We started out by collecting a ton of data that we could just use. And once we had a ton of data, we began sort of analyzing how we could fit it into mathematical formulas to predict the different aspects we were asked to predict. And so we then sort of broke off into little groups and did our own work from there.
And Ryan, as I understand it, this was in particular looking at e-cigarettes and vaping and how that might affect nicotine use among high school students. Does that feel like an issue that hits close to home that you see people struggling with actually in your high school?
Yes, yeah. So that is something that I thought was really cool is the competition. This M3 challenge always does problems that are related to sort of the world as it is right now. And this one for sure hit close to home. I've seen people using e-cigarettes. I know people who use them. Our school has sort of struggled with figuring out how to control that. So it was something that, I mean, it kept our interest because it was something that we see firsthand. And then additionally, yeah, it was really cool to solve a problem that has real societal application. And the predictions we made in this problem, like over the next 10 years, we can actually look to see how good our models were, which is really cool.
Now, Ryan, you're a junior. I don't want to put you in a pigeonhole just yet, but would you consider a career in math or computer science or some related field?
Certainly. Well, so we actually, Jane Street was, I think it's a financial firm that hosted us when we went to New York, and they talked about some of what they do, and I found that sort of fascinating. So that's something I'll certainly look at. But then the other thing is I think what this competition has showed us is the value of math in anything you do. So even if I go into something that's seemingly completely unrelated to math, having a great basis of knowledge in math can help me to become a more skilled worker in any career path and sort of better understand the world around me.
And Ryan, as we wrap up, I just remember the line in The Martians where Matt Damon says, I'm going to clean up the language, let's math this stuff. Having been through this experience, do you like see a problem or hear about an issue in the world and now you think, hey, let's math this. How do we figure out how that's going to play out?
Yeah, definitely. I think this has certainly shown me how math can be used to solve really any problem, even problems we don't know exist. And that quote you're referring to, I have to chuckle because I basically felt that exact way when we opened up the problem. And there were a few points throughout those 14 hours where I think my friends felt the same way, where suddenly it clicked and we're like, yeah, let's math this. Let's go for it.
That is such an interesting way to use math. And so interesting, since that was before the vaping crisis really happened in Wisconsin and across the country.
It also reminds me of a conversation we had with mathematician Eugenia Chang about how we can use math in all kinds of ways every day.
Well, coming up, we're going to listen back to your conversation with Jonah Larson. He's a crocheting prodigy who was just 11 years old when you talked with him. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Stay with us here on Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we listen back to my chat with a Wisconsin high school student who's studying automotive engineering. She's happy to be breaking down some barriers.
First, Rob, you were so lucky to have gotten to visit with Jonah Larson from La Crosse. What a special young person. And he was just 11 years old when you talked with him.
Jonah definitely does a lot of things that kids his age do. He goes to school, plays sports, hangs out with his friends. But Jonah is also famous in the textile world for the works of art he creates by crocheting. And he has a huge and growing fan base online. I asked him how he got started in crochet.
I first started to crochet when I was 5, and I found a crochet hook in a bag of crafts. And my mom helped find a tutorial on YouTube about it because she has no idea how to crochet. And from that first tutorial, I made a dishcloth.
I saw a picture of that dishcloth. I was really impressed. How do you feel about that first product you made?
Now when I'm 11, I look back at it and say, wow, those stitches are even.
Okay, so it was a pretty good first effort, right?
Yeah, I'm really proud of that first dishcloth.
Now, do you have any idea how many things you've made since then?
Hundreds.
Hundreds. Now, what is it that you liked as a 5-year-old, still now as an 11-year-old, what do you like about crochet?
Well, at the start when I was 5, it was because the hook was shiny. And now it's because it relaxes me and because it makes other people happy to see my work, and it makes me happy.
And you, have you gone to competitions with your crochet?
Yes, I do enter things in the La Crosse State Fair, and I've won quite a few ribbons from that.
Now, are there other people your age doing this at the State Fair?
Yes, there are other
kids
doing it.
Okay.
Yeah.
And what have your friends said about your love of crochet?
They're really supportive, and they say I'm really fast. And they do request hats, scarves, mittens, and a few even ask for T-shirts with my Jonas Hands logo on them.
So describe your logo. What does that look like?
It says Jonas Hands at the bottom, and then it has a handprint of both of my hands together, and then it's just Jonas Hands at the bottom.
And you've put things up on social media and the internet, right? Where do you display your work?
At my Instagram page, Jonas Hands, and on my Facebook page.
I understand people now from around the world have commissioned projects for you. What kind of things have people asked for?
A very common request is my braided cowl. That's a very common one.
A braided cowl?
Yeah.
So that's just like a cowl that somebody would wear?
Uh-huh. Just kind of like a scarf that you wear around your neck.
I also saw people are sending you materials now.
Yes. Now it's happening like 4 times a week. It's very common. They send me ergonomically made crochet hooks with my name inscribed in the bottom, different yarns to try, new crochet hooks, and just a wide variety of things.
What's it like to know you have fans, not just in your community, but around the world, who are following your work?
It's really enjoyable to know that other people really like to see what I make. I enjoy that feeling.
I understand that some older people who do crochet are worried that younger generations aren't picking it up. Are they excited to see somebody who's 5 and now 11 doing this?
Yes, that's another reason they're very supportive. And they want to carry this on, and I want to carry this fiber art on to the next generation.
You watched that YouTube video to get started. What else have you done over the years to learn and master your craft?
To master my craft, I just experiment with different things. And I kind of put 2 different projects together and see what I can do.
Talk about some of your more creative projects. What kind of things have you done?
Probably my stuffed octopus or my snake. Those are quite creative, as in how you could make it look different and look like the actual animal.
Now, do you work from a pattern when you try to do something new, or do you just make it up as you go?
Sometimes I work from a pattern, and sometimes I start with a pattern, but then I deviate from it and make my own little twists, and sometimes I don't use a pattern at all.
Our producer, JC, sent me a picture of what she says is her favorite project of yours. It was this big quilt, and I think you'd made it all out of scraps, so it's just a billion different colors. Can you talk about that one a little?
Yeah, that one I made when I was 7 or 8, and I had all these little yarn scraps in a big tote, and they were piling up. And my mom wanted me to do something with it, and I told her just to wait. And then she's like, okay, now you have to do something with it. And I decided I was just going to grab 3 balls at a time and use a quite big hook and just crochet all of it together and use up all of it.
Describe your house. How much of your house is taken over by crochet supplies and works in progress?
Well, I only have 3 works in progress at a time.
Okay.
Lots of crocheters have a ton and then they just stay in totes. And they don't finish them. I only let myself have 2 or 3, and I have to finish one before I move on to the next one.
Oh, that's really smart. So you don't end up with that thing in the corner that you just never finish.
Yep, that I don't like that.
Have you started teaching other people how to do crochet now?
No, not yet. But I've taught a few kids at school how to do a few simple stitches just to get them started.
And are they into it? When they try it, do they get, pardon the pun, hooked?
Yeah, they do.
Do you have any other hobbies apart from crochet?
Yes, I do. I'm very well-rounded. I am in cross-country basketball, play with my brother, my siblings, have family time, which is important, and yeah.
And are you hoping to make money by crocheting over the years?
I already do. I do a lot of that.
Okay. Are you setting money away for college?
I do 4 things with the money I earn. I save some for retirement in college, spend some on myself now, invest some back into my hobby, and most importantly, donate some.
Oh, what kind of things do you donate your crochet earnings to?
Well, I gave some of my items to a nonprofit organization called Roots Ethiopia, and they auctioned my things, and they raised $400 for the same region where I was adopted from.
And before we wrap up, Jonah, you said you usually have about 3 projects going. Can you tell us what your works in progress are right now?
Right now, I am working on a larksfoot afghan in a blue, variegated blue, green, and white, and a cream. And I'm also working on one of my braided cowls, which is an order. And I am in the middle of creating my own pattern and my own cowl pattern.
That whole conversation just put a smile on my face, and he's so well-spoken.
And he's doing great things. I love that he gives to charity as part of his business plan. I also think he can teach a lot of us about starting to save early for retirement.
Well, I bet a lot of people might be surprised to hear about a little boy who is so into crocheting. Rob, you also talked with a young woman who was really enjoying taking automotive class, too.
Yeah, when we talked to Adriana Eddy, she was a junior at West Salem High, and she was very aware that she was not the typical student that people might expect to see in their automotive and diesel program.
Well, no one really expects a girl to be in this industry, so being able to represent that even in the smaller school is really great. They get to see what you can do as a girl and how you can still work with guys and do, if not better, than they are doing as well. You also get to learn different sides to working with your hands to be able to, if one day you needed to, be able to fix your car by yourself and not rely on someone else to do it.
Can you talk about some of the projects you're working on or have worked on lately in the class, Adriana?
Yeah, so before we got into our new shop, we started out at our bus garage. We really identified the issues on diesel trucks, so hydraulic brakes on school buses, and we just looked around at all the different kinds of situations you would go through when you're examining a project or how long you think it's going to take, what devices you should be using, what skills you should be using for which projects. Also, we toured a lot of actual yards and, like, places that you would take your truck to in this area. So that was really helpful to see what it would be like if we actually went out in the real world and was working on this. We also worked on a Freightliner truck and we redid the brakes on them. That was really cool. Got to see how the hydraulics works in that specific truck, and we got to learn book-wise about how we can deal with that in different kinds of situations.
Adriana, I don't want to lock you into a career path yet. You're a junior in high school. That said, do you see this as a possibility going into something related to mechanics?
Definitely. I'm definitely looking at the diesel technical part at TC. Even if I don't end up doing that, that's always a back coach I want to be able to go on. So I really look forward to either doing that, pursuing that in the future, or either getting more information so I can not have to always go to a mechanical shop if I have to.
Adriana, are you selling this program now to maybe the freshmen and sophomores at your high school?
Oh, yeah, definitely. If they're about to be in a car and need some help figuring out what to do with it, if they have no idea, that's a really good way to start. We have auto fundamentals here. I did that this year, and we always start off with WAE, and we get to build, get to learn about wind dynamics and all that other stuff, but then you eventually get into the automotive, and if you keep pushing yourself, you're eventually going to get into the night class. It takes a lot to be in the night class. If you're not willing to put in the effort, you're definitely not going to make it. But if you are even willing to show up one night a week, then you're definitely going to be able to push through. And Mr. Lathan and all the instructors are very helpful. If you have any questions, you're not afraid to ask dumb questions sometimes, because they'll just give you it straight if you have any questions. And it's just really easy to talk to them and get information about why they should do it as incoming freshmen.
As we start to wrap up, for students around the state who maybe don't have a program like this, what would you say to them if they haven't thought about, you know, checking out mechanics, automotive, that kind of thing, maybe to invite them to at least explore it?
Well, you're never going to know unless you try. So, I mean, if you are looking at it and you're like, well, I don't think I'd be good at it. I didn't think I'd be good at it. And I'm really loving it and enjoying it, even as a female in this work field, and enjoying getting to mess around with all the different tools that you would normally not get your hands on.
She had such a good attitude about how this would be useful to her and others, whether or not it ended up being a career.
Right. Just like the math team champ we talked with, it's so great that these kids see how any set of skills and talents can be a benefit when they grow up.
Well, coming up next, we're going to hear from a young woman who not only performs classical Indian dance around the world, she also teaches it to others to help with stress relief. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Judith Sears Poisson. Our colleagues at PBS Wisconsin introduce us to a lot of really interesting people and stories on Wisconsin life. And one highlight of the current season is a profile of an amazing young woman named Shruti Pautasarati.
Right. I remember that one. She's a dancer, right?
Right. She is. But she's so much more than that. Besides performing Bharatanatyam, classical Indian dance, she also teaches it to adults and young people as a form of stress relief.
How did she get started?
Well, it's a great story. Let's hear it from Shruti herself.
So when I came to the U.S., I was 5 years old, and my mom started to notice that I was speaking more English than my native language, which was Tamil. So she wanted me to go to Bharatanatyam class to learn more about my cultural history. Mm-hmm. So that was really the main reason why she put me into Bharatanatyam classes. She did not expect it to become like a passion of mine. I don't think even I expected it. It was something just so happened.
And you also talked in the Wisconsin Life profile about you that you were feeling a lot of stress and dance really helped you. Tell us a little bit about that point in your life.
Yeah. I think one thing that I struggled with being an Indian American, growing up in Wisconsin is finding a balance between my two identities. For a long time, I thought it was dichotomous in nature, that I couldn't be both Indian and American, respect both sides of my heritage. And because of that, I accumulated lots of stress. I found it really, really hard to pursue Bharatanatyam passionately while also living in Wisconsin and finding opportunities to, showcase my heritage. And on top of that, I think just being an adolescent in high school and middle school just adds a lot of pressure. And just the nature of the competitiveness. So all those things combined and made me really stressed. And I started to notice that I wasn't alone and my peers around me were going through a lot of the same experiences that I had. And I started to notice that when I was talking more about my cultural history to my peers, they were more accepting of it. They started to realize that, these cultures aren't so myopic. They're not so dichotomous. There are so many similar elements, and it's just that I didn't know about it at that time. So I think I grew a passion to, showcase my heritage in a way that combines both my identities, which is the basis of why I started Calm with Kala.
So let's talk about Calm with Kala. So you were using dance as a way to reduce your own stress, but like you said, you saw it in people around you. So you decided to share it, and that in and of itself can be stressful, trying to figure out, do I want to put myself out there in this way? So how did you first kind of approach other people about, hey, would you like to try this? It's been really great for me.
So starting Calm with Kala, I knew was a massive task, but it was something that I was really proud to take because I knew that's the direction I wanted to see change happen in my society. And I wanted more peers of mine to be accepting of their heritage, to be accepting of their culture. So at that moment, I was willing to, go through any strides that needed to be taken. I spent a lot of my school lunches just sitting and calling people and trying to set up meetings just to get myself out there. And, like with anything, when you start a project, it's not all like flowers. Mm-hmm. You go through a lot of struggles, and I was met with a lot of rejections at first. But it was taking those very few opportunities that were presented to me at first and expanding them into bigger and bigger opportunities. So particularly with Calm with Kala, I spent all my school lunches first semester, or at least most of them, finding freshman advisories in my school and teaching them during my lunches. And from there, I talked with the health department, and I eventually integrated Calm with Kala into the health curriculum. So now I have this program at Middleton High School where every single incoming freshman gets to experience Calm with Kala, which is amazing to me. And with that, I started taking it and expanding it to universities. And now I've given workshops at Yale and Princeton and Northwestern, and I'm really able to, showcase that Calm with Kala is a sustainable solution that transcends age boundaries.
So you're helping people kind of find a center, find some balance by moving their bodies, but also the type of dance you're teaching has, it seems to me, a total non-dancer, some very kind of precise movements. Is it almost a meditation kind of moving through those sequences?
It definitely is. I talk about the uniqueness of Bharatanatyam, especially because it's a historically underrepresented art form. And when we talk about the rising epidemic in mental health, we find elements in Bharatanatyam to be uniquely, centered around mental health therapies. I always talk about in my workshops how there are three different elements of Bharatanatyam. We have our facial expressions, our hand gestures, our footwork, and all these elements, when put together, make a complex sequence of movements. But really, when you dissect them, they're all just simple movements that anyone is able to do. And I think that's one thing that makes Bharatanatyam super unique, because you're able to explore these movements that are really, really simple in its roots. But when you put it together, you get this, you know, expansion of an art form or an artistic expression.
It's very, very expressive. And we will certainly post the video of you performing so people can find that. But besides being a high school student, besides starting this organization to share what you've learned, you also perform all over the world.
I do.
What is that like?
I think it's a blessing that I have the resources and a supportive family to take me around the world and follow me wherever I go to perform. So I really, really wanted to, you know, bounce off of that and make use of that. And dancing has been my passion since I was 5 when I started. And I think before Calm with Kala and all of that started, dancing was my way to express myself. And so because of that, I wanted to express myself in any way possible. Mm-hmm. So I found myself doing collaborations in New York with other artistic disciplines. And then I found myself going back to India and honing my technique with master teachers. And I think being Indian American gives me this unique, unique opportunity to explore two mediums of art forms. And I think by that, what I mean is that I'm able to not only hone my technique and further myself as an Indian classical dancer, as a Bharatanatyam dancer in Chennai, and, you know, perform at some of the top auditoriums, I'm able to come to America and explore different art forms, collaborate with jazz, poetry, and these opportunities, you know, wouldn't be presented if I had just been raised in India. And at the same time, honing my technique and becoming a more technical classical dancer wouldn't have been presented if I was just born in America. So I think being Indian American supports me in a lot of ways to explore the different mediums of artistic expression in Bharatanatyam itself.
So it sounds like when we first started talking, you said that you felt a little torn between the two identities and like they weren't working together. Now, years later, it seems like not only have they come together, but you feel that much more strong and have so many more resources because of them.
Yes, exactly.
What would you say, Shruti, to someone maybe your age, maybe someone older, maybe someone my age, who is feeling kind of overwhelmed and just doesn't know how to kind of get out of that place of stress and feeling overwhelmed?
I think one thing that we need to note is, like, you know, stress is just a human emotion. We all go through it. It's nothing that someone faces alone. And we have to destigmatize stress, because we put a lot of weight into it and we try not to talk about it because we think other people aren't going through it. But no matter what race you're from, what socioeconomic status you're from, whatever age you are, everyone goes through stress. And I think if you are stressed, again, which everyone goes through, is to just find your support system and just talk about it. I think talking about it is one way that, you know, helps, you know, reduce our stress level. But, you know, going back to self-expression, just finding your medium of self-expression, whether that's talking, dancing, singing, acting, finding your medium of self-expression really, really helps de-stress a person.
Well, Shruti, thank you so much and best of luck to you.
Thank you so much.
I really enjoyed meeting Shruti. She has such great energy and is such a wonderful young woman.
And that form of dance is demanding to perform. I speak from experience. Okay, no experience. But I do remember in that Wisconsin Life segment that they do 2-hour solo recitals. That's a lot.
It's crazy, really. And it really is beautiful, too. We have a link to the Wisconsin Life segment over at WPR.org/Central Time. And people can see her teaching at Middleton High School in that video, too.
Amidst all these stories of youth, we have a great Christmas story for you with our own. You hear in the morning news every day, Melissa Ingalls. Hey, Melissa.
Hey, how's it going?
Oh, good. Now, you shared this story on Facebook that caught our eye of your own youth. Can you tell us about it?
Yeah. When I was little, I was extremely attached to my pacifier, which we called a pipple. And my father, yeah, I know that's a strange one. My father thought I was never, ever going to give it up. So he came up with a plan around Christmas time for this.
Right. I love this plan. Talk us through. This is good parental thinking here.
Okay, so he takes me aside. He's very serious. Christmas is coming. Santa has a new baby reindeer. Aww. who's going to be helping pull the sleigh. But the baby reindeer is kind of nervous because this is a big deal. And I think, my dad says, if you give up your pacifier, I'll give it to Santa, and Santa will give it to the baby reindeer, and the baby reindeer will have your pacifier and won't be scared. And all the presents to all the boys and girls will go out on Christmas night. So no pressure. No pressure at all.
And this worked?
Yeah. I remember crying, and but I guess if the baby reindeer needs it, then I can give it up.
Well, our listeners are all wondering, was the baby reindeer okay?
The baby reindeer was fantastic, soloed with the pipple in its mouth, and Christmas happened.
And you didn't catch on that there was a drawer with like six packages of pacifiers in it?
I found one the following summer, and my father said, well, that was just the backup. The other one was the one I gave to Santa.
That's the rest of the story. Thanks, Melissa.
Thank you.